The farm system is one of the thinnest in baseball when it comes to position player prospects. They have pitchers, they have arms, but they don't have a whole lot of bats in the system.
Ah, this is the time. This is that time of year for college baseball fans. Scotty Brown, J.J. Cooper, and Teddy Cahill with us on Baseball America's Hot Sheet. Welcome to the party, and welcome to the time when we start on college baseball. I know often we talk about the top prospects, and we will. We're going to get to that in just a second. We will get to Jackson Holliday and even the Ronald Acuna Jr. injury and how that affects the Braves and potentially their farm system. But let us start with a little college baseball talk. We are coming off of Selection Monday. We had a great preview show that still is very relevant to learn about many of the teams involved right now in the college baseball scene. If you want to check that out right here on the Baseball America YouTube channel, that show went down on Friday. You can also catch the podcast version of that show on Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your pods. And lastly, I would encourage everyone to send us questions because we are pretty good with the instant Q&A. So first off, Teddy, you get to lead off the show and tell us how we did on Friday's show compared to Selection Monday.
You know, I feel like what we talked about on Friday was relatively what happened on Selection Monday. The committee did a lot of things by the book. There were some surprises. On Friday, I definitely would not have seen Arizona hosting a regional. But by the time Selection Monday came around, they had won the Pac-12 tournament title to go with their Pac-12 regular season title. And so they wind up as a regional host. Their RPI was a little bit low, but you know, to reward a team in a major conference that won both titles, that's completely normal. I think we talked about, was Georgia going to get a top 8 seed? Was the SEC going to get 5 of the top 8 seeds? And they did. That was a little bit surprising, but that's just kind of representative of where the SEC is. So I think that there were some surprises on Selection Monday. There are every year. That's just part of the process. It's a subjective process. But I think it was not a stunning turn of events in any way.
Teddy, you were the star of the show on Friday, and you are going to continue to be the star. So I have a million questions for you. I'm going to jump to the next one for you right now. A two-parter, and you can answer. One, a regional to watch. And two, where should we have our upset alert meters on high?
So I think that you could make a case for both of those being Stillwater. I think that Oklahoma State comes in having won the Big 12 tournament. They've won 9 of their last 10 games. But in that same regional, you have Nebraska, which just won the Big 10 tournament. You have Florida. Florida is a team that is just one game over 500 overall, but is among the most talented teams in the country. Jack Caglione, everyone knows what he's capable of. They played for the national championship last year. So I think that makes for a pretty compelling regional. And the 4 seed in that one, Niagara, not a team many people are going to be familiar with, but I don't think they're a pushover at all. And then I think for just a pure upset alert, like which number one seed do I feel most confident that like they could be upset? I think we got to go to East Carolina. They're the number 16 seed. So maybe that's a little unfair that, you know, I'm just saying, well, it's the worst team. Of course they might lose, but they drew Wake Forest to go along with them. And, you know, that's a really difficult assignment. That's a team that came into the season ranked number one. They have 3 projected first round picks. If depending on how Wake Forest decides to handle its pitching, East Carolina might have to deal with Chase Burns. They might miss him. We'll see. But no matter whether they see Burns or not, you know, you've got Kurtz, you've got Severkin, you've just got so much talent with Wake Forest, and there's a lot of pressure riding on ECU. So I think the Pirates are on upset alert for me.
The other thing I kind of want to ask you with that is like with ECU, we kind of got a big unknown this week also, don't we?
Yeah, I mean, Treya Savage, their ace, he's a, you know, likely All-American. You know, he is a guy that you could really be a huge difference maker for them this weekend, any weekend throughout the tournament. But he did not pitch last week. He was hospitalized. He had a partially collapsed lung. He is anticipated to be back this weekend. That's what Pirates coach Cliff Godwin said on Sunday or Monday. Days blend together now, but in what capacity, we don't know. So just if we do get a matchup of Treya Savage versus Chase Burns, that would be amazing. But we just have to wait and see what kind of shape Yesavage is going to be in.
All right, Teddy, let's get to tournament expansion for a moment, if you can.
Yeah, so that was a topic of discussion on the selection show. ESPN commentators Mike Rooney and Kyle Peterson both weighed in and advocated for tournament expansion at the end of the show. And their point was basically that if you expand the field by eight teams, that some of the bubble teams that people were upset about getting left out, well, they would be put in. And I mean, that's probably true if you have to get those eight teams from somewhere. But you just move where the bubble line is at that point. If we're talking about a 64 team tournament, the bubble line is right now focused around, you know, Lamar or Cal or Charleston. If we move it out a little bit, it's the same problem just with different teams. You know, UNC Greensboro wasn't talked about as a bubble team in this version of the tournament. In a 72 team field, we would be talking about how UNC Greensboro won the Southern Conference and got left out, or how Hawaii finished third in the Big West and closed really well, but got left out. And isn't that just such a terrible omission? Like, don't the Rainbow Warriors deserve a chance? And so, I mean, no matter what you do, until you expand the field to include the entirety of Division I, there's going to be teams that get left out. And tournament expansion probably is coming. That's something the NCAA has been talking about for a few years, something they want to happen. It's a matter of getting the number right and getting the format right more than anything else right now. But I think we are going to see an expanded tournament sooner than later in college baseball.
Okay. And I think the number one question you probably get from an expert like yourself is, who's winning this damn thing? So take me through your thought process of how you pick a winner.
So I think when we're looking at this, you know, you can try and pick a winner in a number of different ways. You can just say, well, we're going with the favorite. That's probably Tennessee right now. They're the number one seed. And that's fair. But the number one seed has not won the NCAA baseball tournament since 1999. So I like to expand out from, just relying on the favorite or something. And I'm looking for a team that's playing well right now. I'm looking for a team that has good pitching, that has tournament experience. I really think tournament experience is a big deal in the baseball tournament. And so I'm going to pick LSU. They played incredibly well down the stretch just to get into the field. They were SEC tournament runners up. They had a 7-game winning streak snapped on Sunday when they lost the tournament championship game to Tennessee. Obviously, they have experience. They won the title last year. Gage Jump and Luke Holman at the front of the rotation have pitched as well as anybody down the stretch. They have a real bullpen ace in Griffin Herring. The lineup is not as good as last year, but if you're starting with Tommy White and Jared Jones in the middle of your order, that's a great place to start. I like what LSU is doing right now. I'm going to ride the momentum, and I'm going to ride the Tigers, even though they did get a very difficult draw getting sent to Chapel Hill to open this thing.
I know it's not easy to make picks, but how has it gone for you in the past?
Well, last year I picked LSU, and I got that one right. But it is very challenging. More years than not, I don't get it right, but I did get it right last year. So we're running it back with the same team.
Hey, one question that's popped up on socials is the committee transparency. So can you give a little more light on, you know, how you feel the game can be improved in that way, or I guess the selection committee can improve in that way?
Yeah. So a big concern in this year was just how many selection committee members. There are 10 members. They're all current baseball administrators in college. They're all connected to a college. All of them this year happen to be athletic directors. And it happened that this year, a lot of their teams were right on the bubble of something, whether that was hosting, being a top eight seed, or getting into the tournament. And as it happened, every single one of their teams got the thing that they were on the bubble for. They got in, they were a host, or they were a top eight seed. And I don't really think how they got there, it's not a good look that's how it happened, because we don't know a lot about the protocols. There are protocols in place that are supposed to safeguard the process. The member literally has to leave the room when his school is being discussed. And that's great, but what does it really look like in practice? We don't really know that. And if there's a perception of impropriety, or a perception that, you know, I've seen multiple coaches say something to the effect of that the key metric was, did you have somebody on the committee? The fact that that's being openly talked about is a problem. The committee can show their work a lot better than they do right now In basketball, they release a full seed list, 1 through 68. In baseball, when they release the next or the first four teams that they left out of the tournament, they don't even tell us who 65 is. They just say these are the first four teams out of the tournament in alphabetical order. So I would like to see a full seed list. I would like to see who they thought the next team off of the host line was. I think that would be very useful. You know, there are a lot of other places where they could open the books and show us a little more. And I don't know if maybe that's a little bit naive of me to think that that would help a lot of people move past some of these questions. You know, maybe this is just the world we live in 2024, but I think it would help if people understood the process a little bit better, because it is different from basketball. It's different from football. And, you know, just having a little more sunlight in the room, I think would be a big benefit.
Let's try JJ again. JJ, the connection looks good here. I think you're going to be strong. So do you want to follow up and on what you missed too? I would love to get a championship pick from you when you mix it in as well.
Teddy sums it up well there, but basically, I, as Teddy said yesterday in a piece, it's not that the process is necessarily flawed, but the problem is that the process does seem kind of almost very much in a just trust us kind of mode, which the problem is that when things like happened this year happen, where all the teams who were on the bubble, who had committee members in the room, all make it, and all the teams that didn't have committee members in the room who were on the bubble didn't, even if the process was completely above board, it still lacks some transparency here. And I do think that going forward, there is kind of this opportunity here to kind of grow, to kind of build this, which is also good for the sport as, you know, in general. And to kind of go from that to the pick, the thing that I'm always fascinated about when we get to the postseason, it is not 2013, 2014, 2015 in Omaha. The ball does fly better than it used to. But that being said, I feel like that we're in a very offensive era of college baseball. And then you get to Omaha, and the pitching, I think, takes another step up. And so I'm going to be really boring with my pick, and I'm going to say Tennessee, and I would say North Carolina as my other team to watch here, because they're able to score and they have elite pitching. Arkansas has the pitching. If this is a really pitching-dominated, you know, Omaha, then maybe it's Arkansas. But I think Tennessee's ability to both pitch and hit, yes, I know they're the number one seed. I'm picking a very boring pick, but I think this is the Vols' year.
How often does that happen, though? Number one seed?
Never. Never. Not in the 21st century. So maybe I'm crazy in even picking it, but I think this is the year that maybe that streak ends.
See, Teddy, he thinks he's going chalk, but are you if you go with the number one overall?
It's not necessarily chalky. Like, that's the thing.
Yeah, it's a good call. And also, for more on North Carolina, I think we covered them in depth in Friday's show and how odds makers did not have them high up on their list. So if you want to check that out, go for it. Teddy, have fun. Great to have you on. We're going to have you on again, obviously, throughout this little ride. But thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot, guys.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't help you just hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. What I love about Indeed is how much easier it has made the hiring process. Everything I need is all in one place. The ways to contact potential employees, job candidates, all in one place. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Baseball America. Just go to Indeed.com/Baseball America right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Baseball America. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Appreciate you, and give Teddy a follow on Twitter. We'll post some of these clips on Baseball America's Twitter page as well. Also, please subscribe to Baseball America. Unprecedented coverage, as usual, of everything going on in college baseball. And it's not just about wins and losses, of course. It's about the prospects and how that eventually filters into the MLB draft, which is coming up in July. And we'll have coverage. We'll have a show for you, coverage for hours of day one of that draft. So now let's bring in our friend Jeff Ponce to get into the prospect world. And we're going to start, Jeff, with 1-1. And I'm talking about 1-1 in a draft a few years ago and number one in our hearts on Baseball America's top 100 list. That is Jackson Holliday, called up, sent back down when he struggled. And now the numbers don't look good for him right now, Jeff. So can you give us an update on where Jackson Holliday is at? And I have teased this, maybe went a little too far on foul territory, but I was like, is there any chance that Jackson Holliday actually moves out of the number one spot in Baseball America's top 100 if he continues to struggle right now?
Yeah, I think, you know, the way things have sort of trended here early or since he's sort of returned back to Norfolk, it's certainly a question that I think is completely reasonable. The performance has been bad, you know, just overall since he returned on the 27th of April. And it doesn't seem like it's getting any better. Just, you know, for the numbers to have them out there, 240 batting average, 402 on base percentage, which is obviously good, but that's never been a concern with Jackson Holliday in terms of getting on base. And a 390 slug. He's swinging and missing a lot more. I know JJ dug in on the swing a little bit, and we were kind of chatting back and forth on it. But it does seem like he's just consistently behind on fastballs. And it kind of runs the gamut of like 91 mile per hour fastballs that are well located to 98 mile per hour fastballs that are kind of middle. And, you know, it feels like the swing that I saw last year, particularly in that good sample size against pretty good competition in Bowie, he was just more on time consistently, wasn't getting caught in between sort of the fastball and the off speed or breaking ball stuff like he is now, where he's really out in front on that stuff and really behind on the fastballs that he's seeing. His move started a lot earlier last year. Started to notice that it was almost like as the pitcher was releasing the ball was when that, you know, front leg sort of came up. Was getting the foot down a lot earlier and just sort of side by side timing wise. And obviously these things are never like for like, cause no two pitches are exactly the same, but he was getting his foot down at the time that he was kind of starting his swing this season. So he's, and what I'm also seeing is like in the lower half, he's consistently off balance at the point of contact where it almost seems like he's trying to hit from sort of, you know, his back leg, his back hip, and then moving forward. Last year, it was much more of like a forward move, getting that foot down, and then sort of moving forward with this momentum into the ball. Was making better contact, was making more consistent contact. And I think the biggest thing that's jumping out in the underlying data is the zone whiff is way up this year. And it's up overall this year. It's up even more so at a concerning, alarming rate, about 25% in zone, which is well below average. Since he's returned to AAA. So I think there's some concerns with the swing right now. The good thing is we've seen this guy do it before, and I think he's a few tweaks away from sort of getting back to the player that he's been.
Yeah. The thing that stands out to me on this is this is kind of why Jackson Holliday is struggling right now. These aren't things that I'm really that worried about as a long-term issue with him. These aren't issues that are issues that you go, okay, that's really hard to fix. These are things where you're watching a hitter who seems a little bit off right now. As Jeff said, the timing's not there right now in the way that it normally is for him. The pitch recognition is, but the swing isn't right now. He's seen this before. The thing that does jump out as kind of part of the Jackson Holliday story is he had these kind of struggles in the showcase summer before his draft year and then spent the offseason really kind of working on the swing, and that was the swing that kind of off to the races he went. Senior year of high school, turns into the 1-1 pick, turns into the guy who flies from low A to the triple A last year, makes the majors, you know, at an incredibly young age this year, and he's just not there right now. And I do think long term, these aren't even just fixable problems. These are kind of more of kind of, oh, you're in a funk more than it is you have a flaw, but they are things that he has to work on, that he has to fix, that he has to improve, before he could really make a case to come back up to Baltimore.
Mm-hmm. All right. So, Jeff, my next part of the Baltimore Orioles farm system saga, and I mean that in a good way because they're so talented, they're doing well, obviously, at the major league level, and these bats will come around, is Heston Kerstad. He's in this week's hot sheet. Go check that out, obviously. BA, you can sign up for the newsletter as well. He's in there because he didn't get much playing time on the big league squad. And what happens? He goes down to AAA and says, yeah, I don't really need to be here anymore. So that leads to the bigger question of how the Orioles handle talent that's too good for AAA, but they don't have enough playing time in the major leagues for.
Yeah, I think, you know, these problems tend to solve themselves one of two ways. And one is obviously there's opportunity at the major league level. There's an injury to a core player that provides, you know, a runway for Kerstad to see, you know, a long run of at bats, whether that's even just like a week. I think he sort of needs that. This is not a guy that they can sort of work in a few times a week right now. I think he needs those everyday at bats, but he's sort of in this like in between land between AAA and where he's been dominant and then actually getting some run in the major leagues. And, you know, I think unfortunately what we're seeing with guys like this, maybe a guy like Connor Norby, who probably would be up in the major leagues with a lot of other teams. I got a question in the hot sheet chat actually today about when can we expect Cade Povich, you know, friend of our show here, to get the call. And it's like, I don't know, because I can see some value with a guy like Povich or a guy like Kerstad of not using up, you know, any service time. Obviously, they haven't added a guy like Povich yet to the 40-man roster. So there's a lot of these sort of roster management decisions that go into it. And I also think there's an attractiveness standpoint with some of these players if they haven't burnt a bunch of different options already, et cetera, and it just makes them that much more valuable as a trade asset. And I think eventually, you know, the rubber's going to have to meet the road. And that's sort of the second option we can see besides an injury. And that is a trade. And I don't know where that trade happens or who that player is, whether it's more help on the pitching side is what we would assume. But I think, you know, it's getting to a point where I think for some of these players' development, it is getting a little bit tricky. And I think, you know, we've seen it with the Dodgers in recent years. Certainly a player like Michael Busch, though he slumped a little bit recently, has shown that he was a major league player on their AAA roster really for the entirety of last year, maybe even 2 years.
The funny thing about this, though, is like we talk about Holiday, in the outfield at least there's a possibility. Cedric Mullins is struggling. You know, there may be some openings there where maybe they decide to make a move. Talk about Jackson Holiday. Talk about Kobe Mayo. You're talking about a situation right now where the Orioles have arguably the best infield in the American League. Gunnar Henderson has been the best player in baseball so far, arguably. You know, you have Jorge Mateo is doing everything you want in second base. Jordan Westberg's doing everything you want to see out of third base. You know, this Mountcastle's fine. Ryan O'Hearn is a DH mainly, but he's mashing. This is a team that has problems that most teams just don't really have, which is, oh no, we've got too many good players and not enough playing time to spread it around. It will be fun to see what this means come the deadline, because I could see Baltimore going a couple of ways here. I mean, one way might be, do you trade away one of these veterans who still is productive and has value, but you open up a spot and you get something back in another position by doing so? Or is it that you trade some of these young guys? Like Jeff mentioned Norby. I can't really map out a scenario where Connor Norby's fitting into their big league lineup in the next year, year and a half, if everyone stays healthy. And if that's the case, is that a guy that maybe you do move in a deal? And by the way, if you do, that's a better prospect than moves in most of these deadline deals.
Okay, so I want to finish today's show with a major news topic that hit the sport this past weekend. And it's actually a team that would be incredibly jealous of the conversation that we're having right now. And that is the Atlanta Braves. Unfortunately, our sport loses Ronald Acuña Jr. on the field for the rest of the season. He tears his other ACL. This is an injury that he suffered before, and now he goes down with the other knee. It sucks. Fun guy to watch. He was the MVP of the National League last year. But from a Braves perspective, the way we cover it here on Hot Sheet is, what's next? So, JJ, you want to kick things off? First of all, You got to replace Acuña. You're not going to replace the production. I know he's off to a slow start compared to last year, but do the Braves have anything brewing in their farm system to be able to replace him? And if not, what do they have cooking in terms of trade assets? And I brought up the transition because the Orioles can easily make any trade they want at the deadline. I don't know if the Braves can.
The answer is no. There is no one that I look at in the Braves system where you say, oh, that's the guy to step in now that Acuña's hurt. The good news they do have is Adam Duvall was kind of a backup for them. He's been kind of a security blanket for them who keeps coming back over and over and over again, and he could be reasonably productive. They did bring in Kelenic in an offseason trade, so this is not 2021 when Acuña went down. And you went at midseason, you're like, okay, is there anyone in this Braves outfield that you want to be on your, you know, a regular in the postseason? Very different than that with Harris, with these other guys. But that being said, no, the farm system is one of the thinnest in baseball when it comes to position player prospects. They have pitchers, they have arms, they always produce arms. We've got Spencer Schwellenbach, another Braves, you know, pitching prospect coming up because AJ Smith-Shaver, who was up last week, got hurt. He's shut down for a little while, so they bring up Schwellenbach. They always have arms, but they don't have a whole lot of bats in the system. And the reality of it is if they're going to make a trade, it's probably going to be by trading pitching prospects, not position player prospects, to find an outfielder.
What about you, Jeff?
Yeah, I echo everything that JJ says on this. It's just not a farm system that is ripe with position talent. And that's not just close to the majors positional talent in terms of those that could just slot right in and potentially, you know, replace Acuña in terms of at bats and you know, outfield production, et cetera. But they don't have guys like that. And they don't really have anybody that's a standout in the lower minors. There's a couple of interesting hitters and, you know, guys like Jose Perdomo, who just signed back in January, but he's a teenager who's probably 4, 5, 6 years away from major league impact. Drake Baldwin is an interesting sort of catching prospect, but not anything that's super exciting. I think the excitement in the Atlanta Braves farm system right now is around the pitching prospects, but there have been some injuries. As you said, with AJ Smith-Shaver, we're kind of waiting for news on where a breakout right-hander Owen Murphy is. He hasn't been in the rotation last week, and he's not penciled into the rotation this week at Rome as well. So that's certainly concerning. Of course, J.R. Ritchie, their number three prospect, somebody that was a big breakout early last year, had Tommy John surgery and will be back, I think, sometime later this summer or, you know, early fall. And then Schwellenbeck, who got called up to the major leagues and got, you know, Hurston Waldrop. I think really all these guys factor into maybe being tradable assets. You know, there might be some other interesting players, you know, down the list that could be moved. But that's really what the Braves are going to have to do here is sort of once again go into the farm system, package some players together, and, you know, try to get a team that likes their players enough that they're willing to move a good major league player. They did it a few years ago when Acuña got hurt. They were able to backfill with, you know, some solid production in the outfield. We'll see who's available over the next month or two and, you know, what players end up getting moved out of the system. I would guess one of these top five pitching prospects gets moved at some point before, you know, July 31st.
The one thing, maybe they don't even have to spend that much, because the thing that does jump out, and obviously we do know the answer of can the Braves win a World Series without Ronald Acuña, because they did it in 2021 after he went down. And that year they rebuilt their outfield entirely on the fly. And the thing that jumped out, and I think you'll see this again at the deadline this year, is how cheap outfielders are, especially veteran outfielders. At that time when they did it, they traded for Jock Peterson, Eddie Rosario, Jorge Soler, Adam Duvall, who's back again now. No one that they gave up. None of the players that they gave up that time was a top 10 prospect in their system. Pablo Sandoval obviously wasn't even a prospect. And none of them have come back to haunt them in any way. Kalich and Ball were both released without ever making it to the majors. Alex Jackson hit .157 in like 42 games before he was traded for a minor leaguer. He's back in the majors now again, but he's bounced around multiple teams since then. Those were very low-cost acquisitions. You do look at it now, like it's hard to believe that at the deadline or as we get close to the deadline that the Angels or the A's, like could Brent Rooker be had? He's going to be arbitration eligible next year. Could Taylor Ward be had? You know, with players like that where we're not talking about superstars but productive regulars, there were a number of those guys who might fit, who might be available And I do think the Braves have the ammunition to make a trade like that, especially if they're willing to take on salary.
You're right. I mean, Ken Rosenthal talks more about some potential available options at the deadline for the Braves to explore outfield-wise on Fair Territory. If you want to check that out, type Fair Territory wherever you get your pods, or on YouTube on the Foul Territory Network. But Tommy Pham's probably not going to cost much. I mean, it was hard for him to end up landing with a team. And look at the impact that he made for the Diamondbacks in the playoffs last year. And even for Atlanta back then, I give a ton of credit, guys, to Alex Anthopoulos at the time in 2021, because he went potentially overboard in what he acquired, right? Like an abundance of outfielder slash sluggers to help a lineup that had just been okay. And really a team, I guess, that had just been okay for a good chunk of the season, and turned them into a completely different ball club because there was a void. Those players were undervalued or just cheaper to acquire, and they didn't give up much. So perhaps he's able to do that again this year because it's easier to acquire players like that. So we'll see what happens. We know that they're going to be active and make moves because this team is still capable of winning a World Series title with what they have right now. And they've proven that they can do this without Acuna. So we'll see what happens. Really good combo at the top about the college baseball world and what's happening. Thanks to Teddy for joining us. Jeff, thanks for joining us as always. JJ, good to see you every week. And we will see everyone next Tuesday on Hot Sheet, live right here, 3 o'clock Eastern, on the Baseball America YouTube channel or wherever you get your pods. You can catch it afterward. Please subscribe to Baseball America, support everything that they do, and we will see you next week.